Right. This is Karen Brewster, and today is September 9th, 2019, and I'm here with Doreen Cooper, and we are in Fairbanks, Alaska, at the Rasmussen Library, but Doreen lives or has lived part of the time in Skagway, and this is for the Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park Oral History Project. So, Doreen, thank you for making time while you're here in Fairbanks to talk to me.
You're welcome.
And just to get us started, maybe a little bit about your background, where you're from originally.
I was born and raised in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I left there when I was 19 and have lived many places, North Carolina, Georgia, Virginia, and then before I moved to Alaska, I spent 13 years in Houston, Texas.
Mm-hmm. And what's your educational background?
I graduated from Penn Hills High School, and I have my bachelor's and master's degree from the University of Houston.
In
anthropology.
Anthropology.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you came to Alaska in what year?
1992 in August.
And what brought you here?
I got a job with the Klondike Park as their project archaeologist.
Okay. And why did you decide you wanted to come to Alaska after all those years in Houston?
It was a midlife crisis. I had visited Southeast Alaska in 1987. And so I came up with a friend, and we took the ferry from Prince Rupert and went all the way up to Skagway and over to Glacier Bay before returning to Texas. And Skagway was probably my least favorite community at that time because I found it to be very commercial. But in 1992, my daughter, my youngest child, graduated from high school, and she decided to go up to Virginia to live with her dad. And around that area, in the Virginia area where her brother was. So there was a job application that was posted in one of my archaeology publications about applying for jobs in Alaska. So I just kind of threw my hat in the ring, and the Klondike Park called me that summer because they needed someone to come up and finish archaeology reports, and they had a few ongoing projects in connection with the restoration of the historic buildings in town. And they liked me because I had a lot of lab experience dealing with artifacts from historic sites. So when I came up there, it was on a temporary hiring appointment, but they said they expected that the job would last for 4 years.
It's a long temporary.
Typical of the Park Service at that time.
So your experience before coming to Alaska, you'd been doing a lot of archaeology around the lower 48?
No. My personal background was mostly in the secretarial and paralegal field. I worked with lawyers at the Justice Department in Washington, D.C., and then in Houston for many years before I went back to school, finished my degree, and got my master's. So before I came to Skagway, I had not worked as a professional archaeologist, just as a student. But I was a teaching assistant at University of Houston for the 3 years there.
And you'd worked on field projects in the summers or something
in
school?
Yeah, we had a sugar plantation where we were mostly excavating in the former slave quarters.
Oh, interesting.
It was. It was a very interesting project, and it broke a lot of new ground. And so,
literally.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. But so I did my thesis on that project, and then went back into the legal field, working as a paralegal for bankruptcy attorneys, before I moved to Alaska.
Okay, so you came in 92, and what was your first thought when you got off that boat? Maybe you drove up to Skagway.
I did drive up.
You drove up.
Yes, all my friends in Texas were quite concerned, and they said, well, of course you are taking a gun, right? And I got so tired of saying no that I just finally said, of course I'm taking a gun. But, you know, of course, Canada doesn't allow you to bring guns in, so it was quite funny. But, no, I drove up in my little Ford Festiva, kind of packed to the gills with my TV and whatever else I thought I'd need. And so I arrived in Skagway with my wheels.
And what did they have you first work on?
My first main project was writing a report for archaeology excavations that had taken place in 1990 and then in the summer of 1992 before I arrived on a site where they were planning on building a new maintenance facility.
Okay.
So we called it the Block 39 Project.
Yeah, I don't think that's probably the official title on the report.
It is.
Is it the Block 39 Project?
Mm-hmm.
But it's where the current big new maintenance place is now.
Yeah, during the Gold Rush period, there were a series of smaller houses on those lots, only three of which remain and which are actually privately owned that date back to the Gold Rush. I came in after the field work for that, but then they began construction, and there were unexpected finds. I take that back. We knew where one privy was located, and so there was a planned excavation for the spring of 1993. And at that time, I had three archaeologists working for me. And then there were two unplanned finds when they were doing construction of outhouse remains that my archaeologists excavated in 94 when they were doing some utility line work. So it was an interesting project. The remains of the privies were probably the most interesting, and I was able to send some of the samples from what we call the night soil, which is the very, very old fecal remains, I guess, off for parasitological and paleontological, some pollen studies, basically, and then also looking at parasites. And Carl Reinhold down at Texas A&M did my parasite study, and he was quite excited because he did find the first evidence of parasites this far north, although not in huge numbers, they were there.
And now they would have been parasites that had gone through the human digestive system?
Yeah, the digestive system. And I can't remember exactly whether they were roundworms or what type of parasite they were.
It's amazing that they would have that evidence of them would still be there.
Yeah. He had done coprolite research that went back thousands of years, and those you can still see some of the little cases when they do those analyses. So, you can get a lot of information, which is why I always tried to save some soil from those test sites and either freeze it or something, because you never know what advances they might make in the future. So you try to save a few things for future people to research or maybe to take a second look at.
Yeah, and so those privy excavations, were they connected with Block 39?
Yeah, they were on Block 39.
They were all Block 39.
They were all Block 39, yeah.
So you got there first and started helping write the report from previous Block 39, and then you did
new work.
Okay.
Yeah. Because Section 106 of the Historic Preservation Act, which was what mandated all of my work, requires that there be oversight, in this case, because Skagway is in a recognized historic district, and even though this was slightly off of outside of the historic district, the Alaska Shipo had determined that they wanted to make sure there was oversight during the construction phase. Okay. So that's also what I was doing.
Right. And Shipo is the State Historic Preservation Office.
Right. Little shorthand right. acronym, yeah.
Right. We all know, have those that we don't even think about.
Yeah, we do.
What other interesting things do you recall from that Block 39 work?
That was pretty much it. I mean, writing the report, I really got to learn a lot about the residential history of Skagway. Most of what is featured at the visitor center and in previous publications focused on the drive to get to the gold fields and didn't really focus on the people who stayed in Skagway to service the miners and to make their home in Skagway. And so it was a different type of report that had been done before. I think there was only one that done by Kathy Spoody, who was my immediate supervisor. She worked out of the Denver Service Center, that had looked at someone who lived in Skagway, and that was the priest, Father Philbert Turnell.
And that was her, she did a project on, was that his privy?
Mm-hmm, his privy, yeah. And
where they found bottles and
interesting lots of things, yeah. But she left part of it unexcavated. Yeah. I would have left these outhouses undisturbed if they hadn't been in the line of construction.
Why would you have left them undisturbed?
Because it's really better to not excavate things unnecessarily. There's a lot of reasons for that. First of all, it's always better to leave things in situ, in place. Mm-hmm. Second of all, once you dig up something, there's a lot of costs connected with it. First of all, if you're finding artifacts, you have to analyze those artifacts. So rule of thumb, maybe 1 week in the field equals at least 1 month to 6 weeks in the lab.
Wow.
By the time you get all the artifacts cleaned and processed, and then the information about each artifact stored in a database and codified. So it's a huge undertaking. And then once you've gone through all that, there's the associated cost of curating artifacts, which, especially with historic sites where you have tons of nails and big chunky pieces of metal that all have to be kept in climate-controlled storage and preserved for eons to come, it's a lot of costs associated. Yeah. Those are all hidden costs that it took people a while to start thinking about and really recognizing. Plus, all the records connected with the excavation should be stored properly. All the photographs need to be indexed. All the field notes need to be duplicated so that they can be archived. So at the time, I really learned a lot about that process from Debbie Sanders, mm-hmm. who was the Parks Museum curator. And I think first I was kind of bucking against it. I'm like, oh, no, I need all my stuff. But then I realized how important that part of the process is. So we developed an excellent working relationship, but there's a lot of costs associated with archaeology when you do it right.
Yeah, and it's true. Not all archaeologists are willing to turn over their findings.
Oh, no. There's tons of stuff left at universities that professors have held on to with their dying, clutching fingers.
Right. Oh, I'm going to write a report. I'm going to write a report.
Yeah, I know.
Doesn't happen. Well, and the other part of it I was thinking is I remember from reading Kathy's report on the priest's privy mm-hmm. about some of the bottles and then all this research that goes into where this bottle was manufactured and the mm-hmm. date and what it might have contained. And it's a lot of historical research.
Yeah.
It's not just, oh, this is a piece of glass.
Although often that's what you have. But right. when, that's why archaeologists like privy sites, because you usually find whole bottles instead of when you're doing other excavations in what we call sheet midden, you're just going to get all the little broken up stuff that people have walked on, and all you can do is count it and maybe estimate how many bottles might have been discarded. It's much easier when you have an intact site, but that's also a good reason not to excavate them if you don't have to.
Mm-hmm.
But in Skagway, where there's been a lot of construction since I moved there in 92, there's been a lot of disturbance. And the ones that aren't on public land, such as with the Park Service, they haven't had the curation. But, you know, at the same time, you know, the park has had these examples, and they have some left in the ground, some curated, and the data is all out there. And so, you know, there is enough information to start saying things about a gold rush town. You don't have to necessarily save every privy, even though that would be nice. You know, there are so much costs associated right. with excavation.
What do you say? If it's a private landowner and they want to do something on their property, are they required to do the Section 106 and all that?
Section 106 only comes into play when federal money is involved. So if it's a federal undertaking, whether the federal government is doing the work itself or under contract or as a grant,
mm-hmm.
The other times that Section 106 can come into play is if the government is transferring property from the public domain to private mm-hmm. domain, and I think also if someone is donating, like, private land yeah. to the government.
But, yeah, so given Skagway is, you know, every piece of property there has some previous history to
right,
it.
Right, yeah.
But if somebody, you know, wants to dig a basement on their
private
own property,
land
they can
private
do whatever
land.
They want.
Yeah, the Skagway has a historic district commission
mm-hmm.
that has codified rules that govern appearances,
right.
exterior appearances of the town, but it doesn't cover things under the ground.
Right, and doesn't it also only cover things within those certain blocks of
the designated historic district?
Yeah, so if you live
outside
of that boundary, you don't have to follow those same
right.
aesthetic rules either.
Right. But there's pretty much no commercial activity outside of the historic district, so.
Yeah, but it means that you in your house don't have to have your windows looking like 1899.
Unless you want to apply for one of the federal grants, if you have a historic building, and because there are some types of grants available
right.
to homeowners.
Right.
But then you would have to follow certain guidelines.
Right, right. And or if you have a building that is officially designated as a historic building,
right.
you have to follow
yeah.
different guidelines.
Yeah, either in a historic district or a designated historic building. Or all of Skagway is in what's called a National Historic Landmark. So
oh,
there's
it is.
Layers and layers of designations around Skagway.
So you said you had three archaeologists working for you.
Right.
You
that in 1993, that was April Hayes. She was my lead archaeologist from Houston. And then Bob Daigle, Daigel. He was also from Houston. And Megan Werstadt, Werstadt.
Okay.
Yeah. And I had another archaeologist. I think she worked on the trail and then worked for me after she came off the trail, and her name was Amy Orenstein. O-R-E-N-S-T-E-I-N.
Okay.
And she stayed on at Klondike and eventually married the park ranger, Jeff Mao.
Oh, okay. I've heard the name Amy. I didn't know the
Yeah, and they're now I think he's superintendent of Glacier National Park last time I heard. So.
Well, what was it like coming to work to write a report on an archaeological excavation you hadn't actually worked on? How do you do that?
Well, one of the archaeologists who had worked there was still there when I got there. Her name was Diane Fennickel.
Okay.
And there was another archaeologist there, and her name was Angela. Oh, what was it? Dunn? No, I don't remember her last name. She was married to a guy who studied wolves, and they ended up moving to Anchorage, where she worked for the regional office of the Park Service for quite a while. They were from Minnesota. So she had done most of the artifact analysis. They were just finishing. She and Gretchen Guidotti were just finishing that up when I arrived. And so it was kind of an odd situation because Diane had been an archaeologist for a very long time. But I think they wanted to bring somebody new in with more lab skills. Diane had extensive background in archaeology survey, actually literally all over the world. She had worked in a lot of places. So she and I became friends, though, and she stayed for quite a while, and she was making drawings of the stratigraphy, because what they had done was dug long trenches in 1990 and 1992 across Block 39 and in both north-south and east-west directions. Just Paul Gleason, who was the regional archaeologist at that time, he and Kathy Spoody had determined the research design for Block 39. And so the trenches seemed somewhat random, but had been placed where they might go through where residences had been. And that's how the first privy that we excavated in 1993 had already been found, and we knew where it was. So, 93. So, but it, you know, luckily the field notes were good. I had the stratigraphy. There just wasn't a lot to say about all those trenches, you know, other than showing the drawings. What you really had was a lot of rock from from the glacial deposits, and the historical deposits probably didn't go deeper than 6-8 inches of times. So a lot of it was just described. You could see the various geological episodes where sand had come in, you know, and overlain some of the rock, and then more rock and more sand. And so that's not too exciting to talk about, right? So that part of the report was kind of thin. But it was interesting. There had been some historical research done, of course, before I got there, but I was able to extend that and talk to one of the families, the descendants of the Hillery family, H-I-L-L-E-R-Y, who had lived on Block 39. Dorothy Brady is her common name. She's descended from Melissa Hillery and her children. And so I talked to her and her aunt, Lorraine, and just about kind of their family. And so that was really nice to have people living in Skagway who had once lived on that site. Mm-hmm. And I had already found pictures in various archives. So when I went outside for trips, I would always try to take the opportunity to do research in Fairbanks or Seattle and look at the photos and that were in those archives and So I was able to get quite a lot of that done, and that was real helpful in the research.
And then the Klondike Park has an archive of menu photos. Were they helpful?
You always went there first, you know, because they're organized spatially, you know, by streets or districts or regions or whatever. So that's where you went at first. And Carl Gerke, the park's cultural resources director at that time, he and I were always on the hunt for new pictures, like would go up to the Yukon archives or what, and might come back and would talk to him and say, well, did you see that one? Or did you know about this one? You know, so there was a lot of exchange of information. Carl was always very helpful.
Yeah. So I was going to say that it seems like doing a report on an excavation that you didn't do the excavation on, is that typical, or it's usually if...
I think it is at the Park Service at that time, because they would quite often hire archaeologists who were temporary. And although there was always the intent to write a report, the truth is you're not going to get all the field work done and a decent report done in the 1,039 hours that you're allotted. So it was a constant problem. And one of the reasons I was hired as project archaeologist was because the chief ranger, Bruce Reed, looked back and saw all these projects that had been undertaken with archaeology. And he wasn't seeing reports. He was just seeing three reports, and that frustrated him. And so he really wanted my job to be one of getting these reports done.
So as project archaeologist, it gave you the leeway to work on a variety of things if you weren't just working on one site?
Yeah, as it ended up, of course, there was still archaeology to be done on two other buildings. So I did have to be active in archaeology, just like at Block 39, where they thought they had found everything, but they didn't. We had big, huge archaeology projects at the Moore House and then the Pantheon. And those were both of my projects. So
those are big projects.
They were, yes. And so at the same time, there was this need to focus on the old reports. So for the Mascot Saloon, which had been a huge excavation, I worked with Jed Levin, who was an archaeologist in the Eastern Office of the Denver Service Center. And he flew out to Skagway, and he had an agreement where he was supposed to write that report, and we got that in writing. Ultimately, it was Kathy Spoody who ended up finishing that report.
And was she the lead archaeologist?
She was. She was at the Denver Service Center. So when I would prepare my research design and my yearly budget estimates, all of that went through her because I was all project funded. I didn't come out of the park space funding. So she was in charge of all of that. And the other thing that we did was we worked out a cooperative agreement with the, was it Idaho State or University of Idaho? Wherever Roderick Rixbrague was, where Carl Gerke had gone to school, he and his student were supposed to finish up the Lynch and Kennedy archaeology report.
Okay.
So I managed to get all those things underway. Ultimately, the Lynch and Kennedy report was not found to be satisfactory. I'd still almost like to go back and redo that someday. but it's out there. And so the projects that I undertook, Block 39, the Moore House, I wrote both of those reports. And then the Pantheon, I did all the administrative work on that, but my archaeologist, Tim Kardatsky, ultimately wrote the report for the Pantheon. And I knew Tim from the University of Houston. He also graduated from there. and he came up to Skagway in 1994 and was one of my lead archaeologists, and he was there through, he went away for a year and then he came back, so he was there for 2 or 3 years, and he would spend most of the winters in Skagway. So my other archaeologist who stayed with me a long time was Ken Graham. And Ken became a member of the Skagway community. And once he left the Park Service, once his term appointment was up, he worked for the fire department for a while. And I think he's still a first responder, but I think he's involved more in tourism now. Mm-hmm. So.
Mm-hmm. So for the Moore House and the Pantheon, which were your projects, were you out there in the field digging along with these other people, or you were in the office?
For the Moore House, excavations took place in 1993 and 1994. And I was out at the site somewhat, but I was also involved in writing the Block 39
report. Oh, you were still writing that?
Takes a long time to write the report. They end up being like inches thick.
Yeah. So, well, and also with Block 39, they found other things.
Right.
So that started in 92, and you were still doing work on it.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a large crew in 90. I'm trying to remember. Oh, 94, I think it was just Tim and Ken. Yeah.
And then the Pantheon was after that?
The Pantheon excavations started in 1995 in the empty lot south of the building itself. And my archaeologist for that year, because Tim had gone, was Michael Kell. And Michael is now an archaeologist with the Alaska State DOT. Mm-hmm.
So the Pantheon was just that 1 year, 95?
No. That was the beginning of the project. My other archaeologists for that year were Lisa Hedman and Christine Stevenson. And they did some field work, but they were working in the lab because I always had to have archaeologists in the lab working on artifacts from the prior year. We always ran behind. I did manage to hire one person who did not have an archaeology background, but to do my artifact analysis in the winter times, and that was a lady by the name of Deborah Betcher, who mm-hmm. is still with the Park Service.
She
is. And the on the museum side now, but she had a background, she had a very diverse background, but one of the things she had done was to sit there, because she had a biology background, was sit there and count fish going up, migrating up fish ladders. I figured anybody who could do that could sit there and count nails quite effectively. So, and Deb's a very bright person, and she there's a lot of tedium involved in analyzing artifacts, and she was just very good at putting up with that, and she found the projects interesting, and especially when she had a chance to do a little bit of research on something that wasn't a nail, was a little more exciting than a nail, but she tolerated the nails quite well, too. So that really helped keep the projects moving.
So she would do things like she was numbering every object and cataloging mm-hmm. them and describing them.
Yeah, and that really worked because she had a different job in the summer. And, of course, in the summer I would bring another archaeologist. But she was my winter person, and she needed a job in the winter. So just worked out perfectly. So mm-hmm. That managed to keep the projects moving along. But I was responsible, like Deb or my other archaeologists, they would catalog everything and then leave them out on a tray for me to just kind of go behind and make sure. We had a, Debbie Sanders and I had written up a cataloging guide, and we had a particular database that the information was put into, and the database was begun by Kathy Spooty. It was an old D-Base 4 type of thing. But there were certain fields that were included that we put in this database that had nothing to do with archaeology but had everything to do with park curation. And so we were trying to do two things with this database. We were trying to be able to have a computer database that would easily slide over to the archival side so that it would make it easier for Debbie and her staff to then archive these artifacts. And then that there would also be enough information in the same database where I could pull out reports on the types of nails, how many nails, and have them all tied to the unique provenience, because everything was given a unique lot number when it came out of the ground.
And in archaeology, it's very important to know where it came
from. Otherwise, it's kind of meaningless.
Right. And where it is in relation to the other objects you find and
right.
All that.
So the lab, you know, I was lab supervisor, and so a lot of my time, you know, was just making sure that you think everyone looks at a nail or a piece of metal the same way, but really everyone sees things a little different. So my job as supervisor was to maintain consistency on glass color, just the way things were described, mm-hmm. so that we knew we were looking at all apples, not apples, oranges, grapes, cherries.
Right. So you standardize the terminology and things like that.
And then not just that, but then the way people, my archaeologists, perceive them. You know, it's, you know, okay, this is this or whatever. So just to maintain the consistency. And that all worked pretty well, but it's very time-consuming, you know. Both the artifacts from Block 39, except for really one privy, there wasn't a terrible high quantity, but we had a lot of artifacts coming out of both the Morehouse and the Pantheon excavations. Because in 1996, when Tim came back, they began the rehabilitation of the Pantheon. And because the building was on that site, we couldn't get underneath the building while it was still standing there. We had kind of pulled up some floorboards and run some tests, but we didn't really get anything. But they ended up literally, that building was hanging in the air while they dug out the excavation. And part of it was by hand almost. Well, while they finally got underneath the building, they did find things. And they found at least one, whether it was a water closet or something, but there were several things over there that during the construction phase, my archaeologists had to go over there. In fact, when it came down to it, it was just Ken and me in like October when it was cold and we're down in the hole there. So I definitely spent my time, my share of time down in excavation holes.
Yeah. Well, as I know, I've heard about the mascot, you know, they were all like crawling around underneath the floorboards and same with the railroad depot. So I didn't know how you get down under the Pantheon. They actually raised the building up, huh?
Well, it was just kind of like hanging because they had to put a new foundation underneath it, a complete foundation. So, you know, they had, you know, a rock thing, a conveyor belt that to throw the dirt onto. But, you know, I knew the guys on the restoration crew, and they knew me, and they respected what we were doing. So if they found something, they called us.
Well, that's good.
So we had a really good relationship. They were all good guys, you know.
Well, so for the Moore House or the Pantheon, as you said, you know, you had to design those projects to start with, right?
Right.
So can you talk about what you do to design a project like that?
Well, in the case of the Moore House, Kathy Spoody had done some prior work there and had published a report, which I think is volume one in the series. Mm-hmm. But mostly she had concentrated on the original log cabin in that site because that was the first building to be stabilized. Mm-hmm. So she hadn't done too much around the house. So I basically kind of looked what they were doing. Normally, when you know there's going to be foundation work, you want to look at least 5 to 10 feet out. And so my method was to throw some test pits. I think we were doing, is it 5x5s or 3x3s? I think it, I don't quite remember the size.
For the size of your test pits?
Yeah. But around the perimeter of the building where we knew, because again, there's just no point in unnecessarily disturbing the soil. So I had to work with the project engine, the construction project manager at the time was Mike Collier, I think, and then it was someone else. I'm not sure when he left, but John Warder, maybe. They would provide me the construction drawings, and not only was I going to look at what they were doing, but where the sewer and water lines were coming in, mm-hmm. so that I could put test pits in that area because we knew that that area would be disturbed. And of course, I looked at historic photos to see where areas of high potential for artifact remains, such as privies, where they were located and if any of the construction activities would be impacting them. So that was my basic rule of thumb, certainly for the Moore House. And so what we found was that around the perimeter of the house, we weren't finding too much in the way of intact remains, and a lot of it dated to when the Kermseys lived in the house, beginning about 1912 and forward. In the rear of the house, which was probably where the older structures had been, we did find in one test unit an area that I believe went back to the original occupation of the site by the Moore family, and some much older looking artifacts. And then there was a large former chicken coop next to the house that they were going to turn into the basically the heating plant for the house. Mm-hmm. You know, it's where they were going to put the physical plant.
Right.
And so I also put some test units in around there. And on the north side, what we found was that on this downward slope, that was a fairly intact midden site that went down from the rear of that shed down into the old relic stream bed that was, you can see in the old Gold Rush photos.
Right.
So we found a lot of remains there, and that turned out to be give us good information, but it was also very time-consuming.
And that would have been the Moore family trash pile, basically?
We found that the upper parts of it were probably from the Kermsey family, but below that, and especially down into the old relic stream bed, the artifacts all dated much earlier, so we believe they were from the Moore family.
Mm-hmm.
We found a lot of... the Moores had children, three children, and we found lots of evidence of children, their little toys and little china doll cups and doll parts and all kinds of things like that.
Now, did you do excavations or testing under the floorboards of the house?
There was a crawl space underneath the house already, so that had been, you know, kind of excavated out. I crawled, in 1993, I went under the house and looked around, and then in 1994, Tim and Ken did do a couple units underneath the house, the oldest part of the house. And we didn't really find much. It had all been kind of disturbed. Mm-hmm. But on the east side of that old chicken coop shed is where we found one of the outhouses, mm-hmm, that looked like it came from the Moore family. So we had a lot of artifacts from that.
So when you're designing the project, you say we're going to do all this test pit work, or does that, mm-hmm, does the test pit precede that? So, and then whatever you find in the test pits directs what you're going to do next.
You start off with, I'm going to put some test pits here and there. And then if there are areas that are going to be destroyed by construction and you do find something, then you are going to expand that because you need to understand what it is and recover any remains that could possibly be significant enough to help us understand the gold rush period. Mm-hmm. So,
and then you have to go and ask for more funding if it becomes more than test pits?
It's a matter of, well, they were, all of my excavations were test pits, okay, you know. I just call them, they're excavation units, whatever you want to call them. But I had already budgeted for so many archaeologists in a certain time period, so I just pushed them. Well, maybe so. Maybe I pushed them. I said, oh, you got to get this done. And then I would go out and help.
Right. Well, and I was wondering about the support financially from the park or regional. That was there support for all this archaeology work?
No, there was no. I was not funded by the park or the region. All of my money came from the Denver Service Center. So I would set up a budget, and they would fund me to that amount. And I submitted my budget every fall, mm-hmm, when the fiscal year ended, and I would put in my budget request for staff and materials that I thought we might need, and so I had to plan all that out, and then I was normally funded for that amount.
Well, I was going to say, it sounds like archaeology was well funded for that time period.
They were at the end of a 20-year stretch of restoration in Skagway, and they really wanted to get it done. So they were willing to fund. And just by creating the position that I filled was an acknowledgement that was important and it needed to be done and finished. So
archaeology is not always one of the top-funded activities, is it?
No. But also, we had the support of Bruce Reed, the chief ranger. I always felt like Bruce was very supportive. And while the superintendent, Clay Alderson, may not have always understood it, Bruce Reed was always able to explain it. And he was very adamant that this should be done. So I had a lot of support from a lot of places, and even up in the regional office, because I would go to some of the cultural resource meetings that they had yearly, and Ted Birkendahl, mm-hmm, and the regional archaeologist, Gary Summers, was the new regional archaeologist when I arrived. They also would say, well, you know, let us know. They weren't going to give me people, but whatever else, other resources. And so I got to know the people up there.
Did they ever come down and help or work on their
own
projects?
No, they had so many projects going on all over Alaska. There was two of the archaeologists who came down from the regional office when they built the new border station.
Mm. Okay.
And so that was a regional office project. We didn't have to do that with the park. So that was something handled by regional staff.
Kind of outside of Well, I guess it's still within the park boundaries.
It's in the... No. I'm not sure. The park doesn't have, like, definitive boundaries like, you know, other parks do. It has buildings that it owns in Skagway, and then it has...
It has the trail corridor.
Yeah, the trail corridor, and it has some spots, some areas that it owns, because they had to buy their property when they established that park.
I was thinking the White Pass unit, maybe some of that goes where the border station...
No.
Oh.
It's on the other side. Well, there's a railroad. It's in the landmark district, but the Park Service doesn't own that.
Yeah, so why were they involved in the archaeology?
It was customs. That's a federal building. It's a federal undertaking, so Section 106 kicks into place.
So the Park Service is the agency who
does 106.
Who had the staff to do that.
Yes.
Okay.
There was a time later after 9/11 when they expanded their operations in Skagway and Haines, and at that point, the regional office had downsized so much that I was hired as a private contractor, and I did most of that archaeology work for the Homeland Security in Skagway and Haines. So that was further on down the road, though.
Right. Well, you mentioned the superintendent support and understanding projects you were working on. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Oh, with the Chief Ranger, Bruce Reed.
Well, you said Bruce supported you, but the superintendent didn't always...
Well, I think a lot of superintendents who come from a construction background or possibly another type of resource don't always see archaeology somewhat as an impediment to getting things done. And they just don't understand why it's important. But by the time I got there, Clay had seen a lot of archaeology being done. He was starting to see some of the reports coming out. And there had been a lot of Section 106 training done at the Park Service by the regional office. Sandy Faulkner and others would come down, and all of the staff, the construction staff, you know, would take the training. And so they had become a lot more sensitized to the importance of the cultural resources that were still in Skagway, and knowing that they were its stewards. And so I think that was an important shift from the earlier phases of the park. Because when the park was established, the National Historic Preservation Act, which is what Section 106 is under, was a new thing. And it wasn't clearly understood. And, you know, it took a while before people really began to understand it and work with it. So I came at a very good time. And Bruce Reed, he had so much experience with a lot of different government agencies, and he was just so savvy on how to get things done, because there were some contracts that I had to have, that I had to do, you know, for some of the specialized analyses that I wanted done. And of course, federal contracting is just, it can just be such a bear. And I would just slam into Bruce's office and throw myself down the chairs. They won't let me do what I want to do. And he'd say, okay, calm down. Tell me what. And he would have a way of making things happen. Say, okay, you can't do this, but you could do this, this, this. And so he was just very savvy on those kinds of things that I had no experience with, because I came from, you know, a background of private industry. Right. So I really considered Bruce Reed my mentor, because he just helped me understand so many different things about how you do things in the federal government, which is different than in other places.
Yeah. Well, there's quite a little bit of a bureaucracy.
The staff there was supportive. You know, Evelyn Meyer, did a lot of the administrative stuff with payroll. She was always helpful. And, of course, Carl Gerke had just had so much knowledge about so many different aspects of Skagway history.
Yeah.
And he was always willing to share his time. And Clydeen, who also did budget, they were just Debbie Sanders, the museum. It was just a really excellent group of people. And Bruce, in the resource division, we would have like a get together every year somewhere, sometimes off site, you know, to make us feel that we were a unit.
Mm-hmm.
And that had not been done before, as I understand it. So you had the rangers, the trail rangers, the interpretive ranger, you know, the museum, me, Carl, you know, who would do an end-of-season meeting somewhere at the, you know, for a couple days and would just go through the year, what worked, what didn't work. And so those were just really good times. Yeah, it just really felt like things were clicking.
Were there times when it felt like that wasn't clicking?
As time went on, you know, Bruce Reed left. We different people came in. They bring changes in direction. Jeff Mile left. Tim Stidell came in. You know, they were trying to create different positions in the park, an administrative position and this and that. So people, you know, Clay ultimately left, and there were, you know, I think Clay might have still been there by the time I left, but there was a new ranger in Bruce Reed's job, Reed McCluskey, mm-hmm. who was also very good, but he was pretty new, and he just didn't understand what I was doing and how I fit into the overall scheme of things, and it confused him for a while.
Were you the only archaeologist there at that point?
There was never an on-site archaeologist except for Carl until I came there. So, and Carl's work focused on Dyea and the Chilkoot Trail.
Mm-hmm.
That was, you know, he didn't have time to deal with the other things in Skagway involving archaeology.
Well, and as you said, Kathy Spooty did a lot of that, and mm-hmm. Bob Spooty, but they were not permanently based in Skagway. She came up seasonally, right?
Yeah, and the problem was construction's ongoing, and you need to be able to respond when they find something. You can't shut down the project for a week and wait for an archaeologist to come in, and Carl didn't have the resources to really respond to that,
mm-hmm.
Although he would take photographs and such, but to actually set up a project, he wasn't set up for that.
Right.
The regional office, Denver Service Center, the park, when I came on, they had all agreed that they needed an arc right there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my job, to mm-hmm. live there year-round and everything. And that was fine.
Right. And were you there during the time when there was a shift in the administration of creating a resources group and things kind of changed around?
It was slightly after me. They had just hired a natural resources person, Elaine
Furbish,
and for a while we shared the office at the Mascot, and I think that was right about when I was leaving, maybe a couple months we shared an office, so I was just kind of at the end of that.
Okay, because I think things shifted, so there was somebody who was head of resources instead of resources staff reporting to the ranger,
right?
The chief ranger.
Yeah, ultimately they created a position which Teresa Tebow first filled.
Mm-hmm.
And
but you'd already left by that point?
Might have been there for a short time when Teresa was there. I don't remember. It wasn't long, if at all.
Mm-hmm.
But she and I talked about some of the projects. I would go in and visit with her after I left. And
because
mm-hmm.
She was an archaeologist as well.
She was an archaeologist, yeah. She had a lot of experience. So we would talk about this and that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember exactly.
So you were there until, you started in 92 and you worked there until?
1999, the beginning, I think, of 1999. So I was switched to a term appointment. First I was a temporary, and then the last 4 years I was on a term appointment. So then when that 4 years expired, my position expired. And it was always a job of planned extinction. It was always considered that once the construction was done, the archaeology reports were finished, that that job would go away. It was never contemplated to be a permanent job.
And how did you feel about that?
It was fine. That's what you sign up for.
Right.
Well, it lasted. When I was first hired, Bruce said, well, it might be as long as 4 years. I made it to 7, so yeah. That was pretty good.
Yeah. And say you didn't make an effort to try and get it extended or to become the permanent archaeologist?
They had a permanent archaeologist. That was Carl, even though his position was classified as a historian. His background is archaeology.
Right, right.
But they didn't need a permanent archaeologist. You know, Carl would have his seasonals, which were doing this section, mostly doing Section 110 work. But without new construction by the Park Service in Skagway, you shouldn't have needed it.
Okay. So do you feel like you completed all the projects you were hired to work on?
Yep. I finished. I wrote both. Both the Block 39 and the Morehouse reports were finished by the time I left. The Pantheon report was contracted out to my archaeologist, Tim Kardatsky, and he finished that, and that was published. And then Kathy Spoody finished up the mascot report. So, yeah, and then Becky Salibi did a retrospective on the 20 years of archaeology at Klondike. So we had talked about that at one of the regional office meetings that Kathy Spoody and Frank Willis attended. And Frank's like, you know, he's like, well, you know, you need something to tie all that 20 years of archaeology together.
Mm-hmm. And Becky's report, too, it ties it all together. Also for people who aren't archaeologists trained to read technical archaeological reports.
Right.
Right.
And I always tried to make my reports readable, but at the same time, as an archaeologist, you have to put a lot of stuff in there that non-archaeologists just aren't interested in reading about stratigraphy and, you know, endless tables showing the artifacts. But my goal was not so much that I was going to come up with great conclusions about the work that we had done there, but that if I put the data out there, that would make it available to other researchers so that they could use that data in other analytical comparisons. And I think I accomplished that goal.
And are you aware of other people having used that data since?
I haven't pursued that.
Yeah.
So
but
I don't
feel
I don't
like
know.
You met your goals.
Yeah.
Were there things that you found particularly difficult or challenging?
You know, each project is unique. Certainly, both with Block 39 and the Pantheon, working with construction and heavy, especially at Block 39, heavy equipment and heavy equipment operators who don't really care about what you're doing, you know, and they're going to just edge up with that bulldozer, you know, and you just got to stare them down, you know.
Were they trying to push you along and work faster?
Of course. Just trying, you know. Intimidation. Male, most the operators were all men, so some of them, you know, would try to be a little intimidating with their big equipment. And, you know, just, and at the Pantheon, that building just hanging there, you'd kind of look up and say, oh, I hope it's sturdy. You know, it's a unique situation. Probably the Morehouse was the most traditional because almost everything that we did was ahead of the archaeology. And the one thing that I felt very good about was that when they did do the restoration of the Morehouse, we didn't have to go back in because they were no unplanned finds.
Because you had done the archaeology in advance.
I had done it in advance, and I hit it all right.
Yeah.
And there wasn't any post-construction archaeology for the workers to contend with. So.
Well, and also they didn't have to dig extra holes for the sewer lines that they planned. They dug where they said they were going to do.
They dug where they said they were going to do. Yeah, so, but, you know, I'd go over and keep an eye on things. You know, that was my job. You know, I'd wander over just to let them know I was still around. Right. And one time when the construction crew was working, I think they were trying to get things done. It might have even, it was on a weekend or on a Friday that I had off. They called Debbie Sanders and I, because they had found this packet of letters that was inside the wall.
Wow.
And it was these love letters that Jack Kermsey, his girlfriend from Los Angeles, had written him in the 1930s.
Wow. And well, so, that's not archaeology, but...
Well, it is, actually. Mm-hmm. It is, because archaeology is not just under the ground, but if you're going to be dismantling a building, I mean, that's all the archaeological site. So, and that was true at the Pantheon, too. In fact, one of my archaeologists, Greg, what was Greg's last name? He ended up in the regional office doing something. Greg Dixon, in 1997. I had him going through the Pantheon building I just had him work with the construction workers as they were dismantling the building. He was there collecting things that they found in the walls or collecting samples of the wallpaper that was being exposed. Mm-hmm. And ultimately they were turned over to the park collections management team. But that is really what good archaeology should be about. It shouldn't just be about digging the holes. You need to look at the totality of the site. So
interesting. Yeah, I would have thought the objects in the building, like you're saying, or the wallpaper, that would be a historian or an ethnologist or something. I think of the archaeologist as the holes in the ground.
Yeah.
No. But then you'd work in conjunction with those other people.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe you didn't have the staff at Klondike. There weren't other people.
To me, historians stay in their chairs. That's what I've seen mostly. But it's not uncommon in historical archaeology for the archaeology to encompass, you know, a view of the whole site. And the other thing was recording that kind of deconstruction and photographs to have an archival record of these historic buildings about when they were kind of taking them apart. Mm-hmm. And so Ken Graham, I had him do a lot of that type of photography on the building, on the Morehouse especially, mm-hmm. Because it is all part of that. So
mm-hmm. You had mentioned the sort of the intimidation of the timing with the construction, and it made me think about just the time period that you have to do these projects. Was there pressure to get them done in a short amount of time? Did you feel that affected the work you did?
The only time that you're going to should feel that type of thing is when you come across these unplanned things during the construction phase, and you know, and the construction has to move around you, so they have to find other things to do mm-hmm. while you're getting the things out of the ground. And so we didn't hurry. You know, we worked at a normal speed, and we made sure things were recorded, but we were certainly aware that, you know, the construction people had to do other things that they hadn't planned on doing while they waited for us to finish. So, but it wasn't intimidating.
No, but that's typical for this kind of work.
Yeah.
That's what I was thinking. It seems to me for sort of, I don't know, salvage or compliance archaeology that you might be pressured for time in a different way than if you're out, you know, excavating some ancient site.
Yeah.
That nobody's wanting to use.
Yeah, well, it's what makes Section 106 unpopular a lot of times, because they can shut down a project like they did in Skagway with Homeland Security when Homeland Security hadn't done any Section 106 compliance ahead of time, and they started digging their holes in the ground, and the SHPO found out and shut them down, and so that's when I was called in. But that's a different story for a different time.
When you do that kind of work, you still follow archaeology methodology protocol.
If you're a reputable archaeologist, you do.
Okay. And I didn't know how you felt about doing that kind of work. As an archaeologist, how'd you feel about doing that kind of work?
It was fine. Yeah. I mean, a lot of my post-park projects have been Section 106, some salvage, and some planned ahead of time when the agencies got a little bit better about understanding their responsibilities under Section 106.
Okay. Well, you also had mentioned earlier, you talked about lab work, and I wanted to go back to that. If you can explain what happens in a lab. Is that cleaning the artifacts, or what are you doing in the lab?
Well, the first thing, the whole lab work starts out in the field when you take the artifacts out of the ground and you keep all the ones together, and you have to know where they come from. So you have to have a system. Each one of those little packets of artifacts has to be assigned a unique number. And so you establish a list of this number and where these artifacts, and that has to be maintained all through the lab process. So you have to be careful not to mix things up. Right. So once artifacts are taken from the field, they could be stored in plastic bags, inside paper bags, just plastic if they're really large, and they all would be numbered with Sharpies with all the information about where they came from. And if it was ferrous, you had to make sure the bags are vented so you don't build up moisture and contribute to the artifact deterioration. And then the first thing that happens in the lab, which may happen soon or may happen later, ideally it's sooner, is that these artifacts are taken out of these bags, and if it's glass or ceramics, maybe bone, they're cleaned in water. There's a lot of dirt, you'll use a brush maybe, and then they're put on drying racks. Metal is probably just dry brushed with a wire brush to just kind of... Nails, you'll probably just shake off the dirt and not do too much with them. So then everything's put on drying racks, and then they're repackaged, and they await analysis. And so you'll probably store them in boxes that show where they came from. And then ideally you will have archaeologists who open those boxes and those bags, and they have a cataloging form in front of them. And at this point in the drying, when the artifacts are put on racks to dry, then they are rebagged, and they are rebagged by artifact type. So you might put all the nails from that thing in one bag, and all the pieces of glass and all the pieces of ceramic in different bags, so that when the cataloging archaeologist pulls open this bag, here's a bag of glass, ceramics, da-da-da-da. And then they have a cataloging form that will be for each type. So you will probably have one cataloging form for the 4D size nails, and another cataloging form for the difference. So all of your different sizes of nails will take different cataloging form, and then a separate one for just the little fragment things. And then the bones, because animal bones take, you just can't tell what they are. We did not analyze the bones. I sent those off also under contract. And David Hulsbeck, Hulsbeck, with Pacific Lutheran University in Tacoma, analyzed all of our faunal remains. And he would send me a report that I then included in the final report. And by the time we got to the Pantheon, he had had many years' worth of analyzing faunal remains from Skagway. So he was really able to put together a...
Do you remember what the biggest, the most number of specimens were for faunal remains?
Mostly beef, but there was a lot of sheep, too. There's a lot of sheep coming up from Seattle. So sheep and beef, and then the fish remains, they don't preserve as well, but we did have some fish, and some pig, not as much pig, and then some wild game, but generally there wasn't a lot of wild game. Chicken was probably, and birds were probably underrepresented because their bones are much more fragile.
Right.
So the big clumpy beef and sheep can tend to preserve longer.
So that lab work is important for the whole organization of what you find in the ground.
So once all those little catalog forms are done, I take all those little catalog forms and I enter the data into a database. I think at some point I had to contract some of that out because it just got too overwhelming. But then from that database, I generate reports, you know, and I would say, okay, these units around the perimeter of the Moore House, we're just getting broken up little pieces here, and pretty much all this area, it's just what people lost. We did pick up some remains from the Kermsey gardening activities in the front of the house, either from soil discolorations or from artifacts that we were finding. The back of the house was interesting because we found a site where it looked like, because Kermsey was a jeweler, and the Kermseys had lived in that house for a while. And jewelers were, one of their big activities was also doing assays. And so around the Moore House, we found several of those crucibles that you would have melted metals, which you wouldn't find around a normal residence.
Right.
So, you know, it was very evident that, you know, there was something else going on there. So that was interesting, you know, things like that, where you could say something a little different.
And was there any archaeological evidence dating back before the Gold Rush?
Not so much. The Moore family, the son and father, William Moore and his son, James Bernard Moore, had filed their homestead claim in 1887. And the cabin sat behind where the current house is. And later, Bernard Moore had it moved to its present location. So that's why we were very careful in the back of the house, because we knew that the old cabin had stood there at some point. And we did find a few remains, and Kathy had found some when she did some work back there. So, but those were the only pre-Klondike Gold Rush. As for the Tlingit Indians who used to come through there sometimes, I don't think there was much on what was at that time the Skagway beachfront to interest them, other than pulling up their canoes there. They did have fish camps up along the Skagway River, and they would have went berry picking. But on the Skagway shorefront, we didn't found anything. There was historical evidence in James Bernard Moore's autobiography that indicated that when he and his father arrived in Skagway, they found some snare traps and some things are in the vicinity.
Mm-hmm. But Dyea was more where the Tlingit community might have been.
The Tlingit community, the Chilkoots went over there because the white man came there.
Okay.
Other than that, they used it seasonally.
Right.
But when, what was his name, established the trading post there? Healy?
Sounds right.
When he put a trading post there, well, of course, the Tlingits were going to go there to protect their interests.
Right.
Because they were very aware of their stake in things. And so there's no way they were going to let that be usurped easily without them at least having some presence. So, yes, then that was, what, 1893 or so, that trading post. So then they started spending a lot more time in Dyea.
Yeah, and I was also thinking, too, the opposite question is things that you may have found in layers post-Gold Rush. You mentioned the Kermseys, who were 1912 or something, but even Block 39, if there were things from a more recent period, World War II or...
There was on Block 39 because during World War II, that was a site where they had Quonset huts spread out all across.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that we could pick up the World War II occupation were these curved washers that were along the ribs of the Quonset huts. They were very distinctive. So whenever we saw that, we knew it was World War II. And that was probably the most common remain we found from World War II. Because they were raised up with floors underneath them, not much. So it was just kind of sheet trash, and then from when they dismantled the buildings.
Mm-hmm.
It's mostly what we found, although I kind of found a watch part from that time period and perhaps a few other things. And I separated that out in the Block 39 report. And I talked about when the Army came to Skagway. And so it was nice to have that element in the report. World War II, when I was there, basically had just become historic. It takes 50 years to become historic.
Okay.
And when I got there in 92, it was the 50th anniversary of the building of the Alaska Highway. So it had really just fallen under the protection of Section 106.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting. When I was also thinking what you said about everybody associates that area with the Gold Rush, well, the other things have happened. And as you say, it was a residential community. People were supplying the miners. I mean, eventually families and kids, and there's that whole other history, and I don't know how much of that shows up in the archaeology.
Well, most of the archaeology before Block 39 or the Moore House or the Pinal Mission, but other than that, it had been in commercial buildings and sites that had been used by commercial buildings. So
did you work on the Pinal Mission?
No, that report was done. I did one thing for them, and that was when they were doing because I was there during the rehabilitation, or maybe it was a restoration. I don't think it was a restoration. Rehabilitation of the Pinal Mission. They, I think, were doing a water line or something and came across this large wooden box structure that Carl asked me to look at. And I think we figured out it was a World War II era kind of gray water box.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. But Diane Rhodes had done the archaeology under Kathy Spoody's direction. They found thousands and thousands and thousands of artifacts. because of the gold rush buildings that had been there, the soldiers that had been there, and it was a real extreme bed, and so they just found a ton of stuff there.
Yeah. Well, it sounds kind of fun.
It is fun. That's why we do it.
You know, the figuring, oh, we've got this, like that box. What is this? Let's go figure it out. And I'm sure had to do some historical research to figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fun. And the park had fairly good resources, you know, for an isolated. I built up the library of books that could help us identify artifacts. And Carl had acquired the microfilm, yeah, either microfilm or microfiche of old records from the patent office. He had purchased that. And so when we found something with a patent number, we could go over and look up the patent number and print out what it was and get the date for it and it was used for. So that was fun.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Neat. And so what did you do after 99 when the job ended?
Did a lot of things.
You stayed in Skagway.
I stayed in Skagway. My husband, Roy Nelson, was still working for the park at that time. And so I decided to take a part-time job as Skagway's magistrate. And I was also working as a tour guide on the White Pass Railroad.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was doing those two things. And I think I was magistrate for about 3.5 years. And then in that same time frame, I had my own archaeology consulting business. So one of my main clients was Homeland Security, mm-hmm. but I also had a few other clients. I did a small project in Dyea and another one over in Haines. And I also went up and did a project for the Park Service up in the Seward Peninsula with Eileen Deviney.
Mm-hmm.
So I was keeping busy. summers were busier. I tended to write the reports in the winter at home. And then the archaeology consulting, it just got difficult. I had a really, really good archaeologist who had worked for the Park Service who would help me out. Her name was Eve Griffin, and she stayed in Skagway and also was not working for the park anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, consulting with the government just became difficult. You know, they were supposed to pay you within 4 weeks, and they were having problems meeting that time frame, and it's hard to plan where your money's coming from. And the taxes and the bureaucratic requirements of keeping registered with all the different things you have to register with the government mm-hmm. as a private contractor. So that was becoming more onerous. And the jobs were dwindling, and I finally just decided, oh. So kept working on the train for a while, and then in 2005 I took a job as bookkeeper and office manager with a lady and husband in town who owned 4 businesses. And so I did that till I retired in 2015, and I still actually work for them now remotely. So
there we go. And then you have been volunteering in the summers at yeah. Coldfoot.
Since 2017, Roy and I have been volunteering for the Bureau of Land Management, the Visitor Center up in Coldfoot, and I help out at the Visitor Center and help out our boss with the Alaska Geographic Bookstore there. And there's it's a replica miner's cabin of replica of the type of gold mining they did up in the Koyukuk between mm-hmm. Focusing on the period between World War I and World War II. And so Roy and I have both been involved with getting that done. We're hoping to see it come to fruition and open to the public next summer.
Cool. And has Roy been helping to rebuild that cabin?
No, the cabin has actually already been in place.
Okay.
But there are things that need to be added and done, the smaller things. So he's been involved in that, and we're hoping to get a handicapped accessible walking trail back there.
Cool.
They brought up a big piece of equipment called a churn drill that's been stored down in Fairbanks. It's now up there, so we're hoping to get everything arranged. I just helped out with a project, a little remote sensing project with a metal detector in the old Coldfoot Cemetery this summer. So,
yeah, I was going to say your archaeology and historic archaeology background would be useful in Coldfoot.
Yeah. I think our background is Park Service employees, and then Roy with his maintenance skills, and me, I can type and do a whole lot of different things. So I'm hoping that we can continue volunteering down the road, you know, that those skills will make us useful as volunteers.
So what are your feelings about having worked for the Park Service at Klondike?
It was a very positive part of my life. It was my first professional job. I learned tons. I feel like I wrote two reports that are worth reading. The people I worked with were great. Made a lot of friends that, you know, it's funny when you get around Park Service people who, you know, you start finding out you know people in common. You know this or that, you know, because you are kind of an extended family.
Right. And
that is a nice feeling. But it was kind of interesting both working for the Park Service and being married to someone who at the same time had worked for the Park Service, but was a dyed-in-the-wool member of the Skagway community, because there's often a bit of push-pull between the Park Service and the community. So in a lot of ways, I felt like I was a little more grounded with the town than some of the other Park Service employees who might try to become a part of the town, but it was a little more difficult for them sometimes. So, So that was interesting.
But you came in as a newcomer, and then you met Roy as the local boy.
Yeah. Well, we worked together.
You were accepted into that community.
Right. Yeah, because I was Roy's wife.
Okay.
I wasn't seen as just a Park Service employee. I was Roy's wife, and everyone knows Roy, so, you know.
Well, and Roy was unique in that he was one of the earlier people who was from Skagway who got employed by the park.
Yeah. And he did that, you know, and some people thought he was kind of being a traitor, but it all worked out.
So once you were no longer working for the park and you were back to a public citizen of Skagway, did you get a sense of how people felt about the Park Service?
Nothing really changed. I think for me personally, my personal identity was more shaped, more than as a Park Service employee, but shaped as my 3.5 years as magistrate, when they knew I'd be sending them to jail or whatever.
Right.
And that was one of the reasons. It's hard to be that type of figure in a small community.
Yeah.
So ultimately, I was just like, I just can't do this anymore.
Right.
Plus, you're on call 24 hours a day, seven days a week. And it was just cutting into our time so much. But I probably, if anyone looked at me in Skagway, they'd say, oh yeah, she's married to Roy and she used to be the judge in town. And
they're gonna
forget that I was worked for the park.
Now, did you ever do any archaeology out on the Chilkoot Trail?
No, that was all Carl's. That was Carl's.
And by the 90s
division.
It may have been done.
The trail will never be done.
There's always something new coming out.
Carl, and I don't know what he does now, but in all the years that I was there, he would also hire two or three archaeologists every summer to continue with the Section 110 surveys of the trail. And then I think later on, they when they moved a campground or something, another campground or site got washed away, then Section 106 came into play. So, years after I left, he was still, they were still doing work on the trail. And I think their most recent archaeologist, Sean, was doing quite extensive work up on the trail above the Scales area in the last couple of years. So archaeology along the Chilkoot is ongoing. Archaeology along the White Pass has not really begun.
Oh, you mean along the train or in the White Pass unit?
In the White Pass unit.
Okay.
That is just, other than I think they're supposed to have a survey, whether that survey ever took place, but that's like a follow-up on what Carolyn Carley did in 1983. So you're looking at a lapse of, 30 years or 35 years. And they haven't really done anything in that area. And at some point, they're going to have to face that and pull some resources over there.
You did it. That was one of my next questions. Are there things archaeologically that still could or should be done?
White Pass City, yeah. Because that is the main unit that the Park Service is responsible for along the White Pass Trail. And every year, you know, people from the train will find their way down there. And if you don't know what you have, then you can't really monitor it. So I think it's like a lot of federal places, you know, they know if they build a trail down there, they will come.
Right.
And so they don't want to do, but at the same time, that just kind of leaves it open for people to go down there. So that's something that the park, that's a big challenge that I think the park still has to face. They pretty much have Dyea and the Chilkoot, as far as I can tell, under control.
Yeah. Well, I was wondering, in the White Pass, is you said, like, why dig it up if you don't have to? That White Pass City is not very accessible, from my understanding. And so is it better to just leave it?
You don't have to go down and dig things up, but if you did some clearing, you would be able to see what you have. They don't, there's no comprehensive map or survey of where buildings might have been, what type of resources are still left down there. So if they have done that survey, then good. I know that money for it has been on the books for a while. But it's certainly a step that they need to take because it's just a big gray area. But the Chilkoot Trail itself, the biggest, to my mind, things that they found along there was when Bill Fortini and his crew, and I think maybe later Andy, who was the park archaeologist, became the park archaeologist because they did finally create an archaeology position there. When they got to some of the caves, the shelters above the trail, above treeline, was where they started to see evidence of when the Tlingit had used the trail. And they found several things like that. And that was probably, to me, one of the most exciting things that they found of that prehistoric use. And that's where you would expect to see the prehistoric use of that area is along the trail, because that's what they came to Dyea for.
Right. Well, and I also was thinking about Roy. I mean, you know, the trail crew, they did so much work to make that trail what it is today. And they must have found things. I mean, they were digging, and then they would call Carl, and he would go check things out. You know, they were building bridges. And
Carl didn't really start until 1986, so they were working on the trail before that, and I don't know. They tended to know where larger artifacts were, but never disturbed them. And they showed me where some were when I would hike up the trail. Because when Roy was on the trail crew, I hiked the Chilkoot Trail, you know, every other week. I could probably still hike it blindfolded, at least that lower part, you know. And then every year, you know, I'd make a couple trips up to sheep camp too, you know. So I knew the trail. It just wasn't my job.
Right. But I was
so I just knew it as a recreational
thing. If you heard Roy and those guys talking about stuff they found.
Really, they didn't find all that much. And they would more talk about their bosses or their fellow employees or just weird stuff. The hikers.
The hikers.
Yeah, problems with the hikers or the rangers, you know, whatever. but their finds, no, not so much. I mean, if they would have found a big thing, they certainly would have notified somebody.
Yeah.
Both Watson and Roy are sensitive to cultural
right.
remains.
So, right.
And they made sure that their assistants were too, so.
Yeah. So other things can you think of that I haven't asked about that relate to your time working for Klondike or living in Skagway?
No. I mean, it's a good part of our life. I spent over 25 winters there. when we left, we were ready to leave.
What's interesting, you mentioned a number of people who worked seasonally and then they stayed.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just you. And what it is about Skagway.
Yeah.
Because I don't know that that is typical for Park Service.
Yeah, Skagway really does have an attraction. Judy Munz, who runs the museum, started off there with the Park Service. Jim Jewell was a... who owned a construction business, started with the park. There were others whose names escape me who made Skagway their home, came there because of the Park Service originally.
Park Service, you think of people moving around a lot.
Well, most of the employees who came and stayed were in temporary positions. The people who stayed, who were brought in at the higher management levels and who had career appointments, would go in and out. Mostly they did not stay, although Reed McCluskey and his wife still own their house in Skagway, mm-hmm. and they have been back as non-park people. So,
I appreciate your time today. I know you've got other things you have to go do.
Yeah, go check on the car.
All right, so unless there's something else you want to say about archaeology and Skagway and your work and legacy.
Yeah, it was what a funny 7 years. Wow, it was so long ago now. I'm surprised I could recall that much.
Yeah, it was great. Well, I'm sure as soon as I turn it off, you'll remember all kinds of things. That's usually
what happens. Yeah. No, thank you. That was a good opportunity. Okay.